أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله الطاهرين. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. Brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to another session of our course from Ali alayhi salam to al-Mahdi alayhi salam. We are in the third section of our course, which is the section where we talk about the ghaiba, where the imam is active despite being in his occultation. Now, this is the 20th session of the course, so it's been quite a long course, alhamdulillah. And as we mentioned, there's a lot of content that was covered and that still needs to be covered, but unfortunately, because of lack of time, we won't be able to say much more, but inshallah, we'll leave it for future course, inshallah. But for the next few lessons that are coming before the end of the course and the wilada of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, we have some really interesting discussions coming up. And today's discussion is something that is going to be very interesting, I think very new as well, something that we don't normally talk about. And it's a topic that's really going to talk about all this ideology that we've discussed, all the theory that we've discussed. And again, just like we discussed with Sheikh Baqir, how things unfold in themselves on ground, this is another one of those discussions that are really going to show what the imams were actually doing in terms of fulfilling their roles, and give us an insight into what's happening behind the scenes in the lives of the imams. I'll let the actual discussion describe to you more. Show you how interesting it is. So for this very interesting discussion, we have Sheikh Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikhna.
Alaikum salam.
Thank you very much for being with us. So let's get started with this discussion.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa sallallahu ala muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin. Allahumma salli ala muhammad wa ali muhammad. Welcome back to all the respected viewers. We're approaching the nights, the blessed night of the 15th of Sha'ban, inshallah, and obviously the end of the course. I really hope that we can benefit, inshallah, from the attention of the 12th Holy Imam, inshallah. And we hope that everything that we did is accepted and a source of getting closer in our understanding of the Ahlul Bayt and really following on their footsteps, inshallah.
Inshallah.
So in today's discussion, so we've entitled the discussion as the network of representatives, right? And as you mentioned, quite interestingly, yes, it's something that I personally rediscovered, something amazing, really amazing. And perhaps I haven't enjoyed research as much as I enjoyed over here. And it really, one of the goals, one of the goals that really I want and to share over here, one of the objectives I have here to share this over here with all the listeners and the viewers, is to really appreciate and view the Ahl Bayt in a different angle. An angle whereby we find that the Ahl Bayt are present in society, are actively involved in doing their role as imams and leaders of our community. So if I could introduce what does it mean, let me just quickly go a summary of what we want to discuss. So if you look at the slide, we want to talk about what is this network first, and inshallah we'll talk about that very briefly. Then we'll go into why was this network set up. Once we know what it is, let me just say, okay, why do we need it? What is this thing, basically? And then when we understand why of it, then we'll go into more details about discussing what these wukala, what their role was, and obviously how did this whole thing function, before we move on to discussion further on later on about the Ghaiba Sughra itself. So this is kind of what we want to talk about. So very quickly, what is this network, what we're talking about? So we find in history that the Ahlul Bayt would have a system whereby they would place individuals to do certain tasks, right? So wakil, the term wakil, the plural of it is wakala, means a representative, somebody who I appoint to do certain tasks, basically. Now, the degree of how much the task is allowed to do depends on how much close he is to me. And so we find that from the fourth Holy Imam to the fifth Holy Imam, there's a kind of a preparation happening whereby they're kind of setting up slowly the system, right? Appointing certain people as being the link through which the work of the Imam happens. At the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, we find that this becomes quite official now, kind of thing, basically, where there's a system in place, and at the top of the system there's an imam, right? And he's organizing his ashab, his companions, in such a way to be able to perform certain tasks that are very important, which we'll talk about, right? And you find this very clearly. And you find that everybody has a position, right? Everybody has a responsibility. And the imam is directing things to happen properly.
So it's a whole system and a network where imam is getting done certain things through these representatives.
Exactly. Yeah. And then when we come to the seventh imam and the eighth imam and the ninth imam, this becomes really strong. Right, and we see amazing things happening, right?
And as the what scale are we talking about here? Are we talking about at the
exactly
scale
you mentioned. So this is as the imam progresses, the empire also becomes big, and you find that the Shias also really expand across the empire, right? From Khorasan to Azerbaijan towards the 11th imam, right, which is very East Asia, right? To Egypt on this side, right, and perhaps even further than Egypt, down all the way to Yemen, right, the whole of Iran, so Sistan, Madain, all that is covered, right, and you find that there's individuals that are placed by the imam, right, and they all network back to the imam to perform certain tasks.
So we're talking about a full full scale, basically, so, right, across the whole of the Islamic
exactly.
empire.
Exactly. So it starts very slowly, but by the time you reach the 10th imam and the 11th imam, you realize that this is working like phenomenal in doing things. And one of the things you realize that, which is extremely important, that's one of the biggest messages I'm going to pass over here, is that you come out of this idea of having an imam who is sitting in his room just reciting dua, for example. You know, when I tell you, for example, Imam Sajjad, first thing you have in your mind is Imam Sajjad Afi Karbala is an ill person. And if you study a little bit, you're like, oh, but he wanted to spread Islam, so he did that through dua, for example, etc. It's a very weak image. Imam Sajjad had an imam of 34, 35 years. Do you think all he did was Saifa Sajjadiya in Risatul Huquq?
So we discussed with Sheikh Baqir in a previous session that Imam Sajjad sort of had to start a lot of things from scratch. Yeah. After Ashura, he mentioned also the hadith where the hadith says that he basically had about three companions, real companions left. So he had to start this this whole work of bringing wilaya back into the community from scratch, and yeah, that requires a lot of work, obviously. But one of the ways he used was through the du'as and teaching the ma'arif through the du'as.
Yeah. And then we move on to Imam Baqir, Imam Sadiq. Again, we find this personality very much as a teacher kind of thing, basically, right? Not realizing that their role was greater than that, right? The impact at a social level was great. And then we come to later imams, Imam Hadi, Imam Hassan Askari. We don't have too much information. Our perception of these imams is like prison, in their room, secluded.
There are very few details about them, right? Because they weren't so present, apparently, in society.
And so you'd be surprised that through this network, right, they're actually heading an organization, okay?
An underground organization.
It's a secretive organization, right? An organization that has a turnout of millions of dollars, right? In now daily, money is coming in and out, okay? Of people across the empire connected together, okay? And in connection with the imam. And the imam is directing, organizing, managing this thing in the most beautiful way, right?
Okay, if it's so big and if there's like a lot of money involved, a lot of people involved, how come we don't know much about this?
So you'll find out when we go to this class today and tomorrow, inshallah, you'll realize there's a lot we can find out from this, right? And from primary sources as well. And you suddenly uncover a completely new picture of how things are working and how this message of Shia has reached us today, right? It wasn't easy, right? That today we can stand over here and talk about the Ahlul Bayt, talk about the hadith of the Ahlul Bayt, be able to go towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this very beautiful journey with this religion hasn't come to us through in a very easy way, right? Mm-hmm. The Ahlul Bayt worked really hard through amazing skills of management, organization, making sure things happen so it reaches us. And inshallah, there's a lot of messages that we can learn from this, and especially this will bring us today as well, which we'll talk about as well.
Yeah, so I was going to ask that before we dive into the discussion, how can we make this whole system and what the imams were doing then, how can we make it relevant to us? How is this connected to today?
So as we go on, you'll see. I don't want to spoil the surprise because it'll be a bang, right? Once you realize how these things work during the time of the imam, you realize that today, what's going to happen then? What's happening today, right? And it really puts everything into picture, and you get this really nice idea and understanding of how things are supposed to work. So just to summarize then about what this network is. So we're talking about an organization, right? An underground organization, beginning roughly around the time of Imam Sadiq, although we find allusions to it from Imam Sajjad's time and Imam Baqir's time as well. And then growing and growing, becoming bigger and stronger and more organized, the whole time managed by the imam, right, in a very beautiful way, with particular goals and tasks and a way of functioning. The people heavily involved in this are called wakala. Now, there are different names that are used, which we'll talk about as well. For example, bab, for example, na'ib, which we'll talk about, inshallah. But we call this the network of representative, or the system of wakala, basically. Wakala being the plural of wakil, which is one who is responsible for certain tasks. So if I can just add over here, one point I skipped over here. So during the Ghibat al-Sughra, which inshallah we will talk about in more detail, this system basically maneuvers around these four individuals that most people have heard about, these four na'ib of the imam, yeah. Right? Especially appointed by the 12th imam.
But I think the picture we have of wakil and naib of the imam usually is about these four that Imam Mahdi appointed for.
But we don't realize that this is just the last piece of the puzzle of this whole system. And this couldn't have happened if it didn't start during time of Imam Sadiq, right? These four naib picked up all the work that was started from Imam Sadiq even before, and it's a continuation of the whole journey. Right, so let's talk about why this network, right? So before I tell you about what the individuals in this network were doing, let's talk about why this network, and you realize how important this network is. I want to go back to a class we had at the beginning of the course, where we talked about what is the role of the imam. And there's a few things we mentioned. So if you look at the slide, we mentioned that the role of the imam is to teach and protect the religion. So really go back to those slides, those discussions we had, where we said the imam's role after the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, is to really teach the people this true Islam, right? And to protect it from being tampered with, from being changed and altered, and knowing that fact that there are enemies out there within and outside as well that want to change things, that want to make sure that because they're devils and in evil, they want to not allow mankind to reach that ultimate perfection they were created for.
Right? There's also the ignorance of the masses, which sort of prevents also and sort of leads to changes and people not being aware of the true religion as well.
Exactly. So the Ahlul Bayt were there to save people from this misguidance, preserve the true Islam. But also on top of this, they're doing tarbiyah as well, right? We mentioned this very clearly, that people are in touch with the Ahlul Bayt, the individual questions, right? Individual advice that people need and require in the path towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The collection of khums and zakat, right? The Ahlul Bayt collect khums, they collect zakat. It used to happen in the time of the Prophet. The Prophet collects khums and zakat. We have this in the Quran, right? And what is the goal behind this? Is to purify one's money, is to purify one's income, right? And we find that this needs to carry on, because it's part of our tarbiyah, right? For me to get closer to Allah, my money and my income needs to be purified. As the Ahlul Bayt clearly mentioned, in this kind of way, basically, that you have children that are halal, for example, your food is halal, your clothes is halal, all of it is why? Because we take homes from you, right? Kind of saying that this is part of a tarbiyah that's going to happen. Helping the needy. Many people amongst the Shias require need, financial need, etc. The Ahlul Bayt's role is to help them, part of the tarbiyah. Yeah. The identity of the Shias. And also one thing that's very crucial, part of the tarbiyah, is that people the society is going towards ghaybat. That's been told, right? The Prophet, peace be upon him, told us about this. So we know the ghaybat is coming. The absence of an imam is going to happen at one point. People need to be prepared for it. So one of the roles of the Ahlul Bayt is also to prepare us for that. A third role that we talked about very strongly as well is the social political leadership, right? We talked about wilaya, and we said how for individuals to have this tarbiyah to happen, it requires a society led by a just government, where the laws of Islam, the true laws and the sharia of Islam is implemented, right? Yeah. In a court of justice, in its full sense, right? Managing the different lands and the waqf, which inshallah we'll talk about as well. And lastly, in the role of the imam, the highlight over here is being a hujja. We talked about this, that the presence of the imam makes sure that nobody has an excuse, right? I can't do it, I didn't know about this, I was misguided, etc. The imam here, his presence is sufficient that the road is open for you, the door is open for you, you just have to take it, basically.
Yeah.
Now, this is the role of the imam. We talked about this before, I summarized over here. Now, let me present to you the reality on the ground. Amirul Mu'mineen, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, they had kind of a role to play. Okay, I want us to picture kind of what happens after that. right? And Imam Ali had the Khilafah for some time. Imam Hassan as well for a little time. Although these challenges are there as well, I want to take it onwards after Karbala, right? When we look at the reality on the ground, there's a few things we realize. Number one is that the Shias expand across Asia and Africa. This is a big thing, right? Now, it's very interesting. Let me mention, we talked about this in the introduction. Let me mention over here. As you mentioned in the previous class, Sheikh Barker mentioned as well that after Ashura, the Hadith tells us that irtadda an-nas, right? The people kind of had abandoned Islam or their true Islam, except three or four. In some narration, you even have seven. From Imam Sadiq, you also have that there were not more than 20 muhib of the Ahlul Bayt. You also have some indication that perhaps around 170 people or so that were kind of affiliated to the Imam. But that's it, right? What's very, very interesting, right? And this is something that we need to ponder upon, right? Is that Imam Sajjad brings about a miracle. We have in hadith that Imam Baqir, there's a person comes to Imam Baqir to meet him in the masjid. He has to wait because there's a delegation from Khurasan, which is northeast of Mashhad, that has come to meet the Imam. That's how much in the span of 35 years, okay, people where Imam Sajjad will go to mosque and everybody just ignore him, okay, suddenly within 30 to 40 years, okay, the Shias have expanded so much that Imam Baqir enters the mosque, is surrounded by people. That's a miracle, right? Like how much Imam Sajjad worked, and the hadith are so beautiful, right? Like how he would send certain companions to do certain things, and you find that he had some wakils as well, right? And there's one guy, we'll mention him later as well. One of the individuals that I mentioned in the amongst the three people or the four people that I left was Yahya ibn Umm Tawil, right? Yahya ibn Tawil is a bab for the Imam as well. It's termed in as a bab in Manaqib, kana babuhu Yahya ibn Abu Tawil, the bab of Imam Sajjad, which I will talk about that later. Very interesting. This person will walk in the streets of Kufa wearing a long robe, eating gum, right? The hadith says, yeah, وَيَمْضَغُ اللُّبَّانِ, which is, he was chewing gum. That's how kind of person he is. And he would go and like spread about this tashayyu within Kufa. Right? These were individuals that were preparing the grounds, right? They were doing the work of the Imam to make sure that when Imam Sajjad passes away, gives it to Imam Baqir, right? The Shias have expanded, basically. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we find that the expansion of the Shias is huge, right? If I can show you a map over here, so if you look at my screen over here, this is the map of the Abbasid Khalifa in the 9th century. Now, obviously, we're not talking that far, right? But you realize that it goes all the way from Azerbaijan on the east, right? Khorasan, right? Sistan province, right? All the way you come over here to Iraq, obviously, Baghdad, Samarra, Kufa, right? Basra. Go south, Medina, Makkah, obviously. All the way south to Yemen. Go a bit more west, Egypt, Misr, right? All across these are Shias, 6th Imam, 7th Imam, 8th Imam, and you find that I was looking at the map, Khorasan to Medina is approximately 2,800 kilometers. That's about a month of worth of traveling, right? If you have a question to ask the Imam, right? Or let's say the Imam passes away, for the news to reach about who the next Imam is and how everything is going on and how I can give my homes and how it takes a month. Right? The Shias have expanded, right? It's a very important factor for us to realize that the work of the Imam, right? We talked about all these roles. The work of the Imam takes a very big challenge.
Yeah. I guess to have the people updated and informed about different things and the teachings spreading and all that, it takes a long time. It's not like today with social media, you just send things around. Yeah. So you definitely need to think about how to manage this.
Exactly. Yeah. So these rules, how to teach the Islam to these people in Khorasan, in Azerbaijan, in Misr, right? How do you do the tarbiyah of these individuals? How do you answer them individual questions, right? Yeah. How do you establish a government over there? How do you do all these things across these various lands? I mean, Imam is one person. And I think throughout the course, we've mentioned this so many times that this is the beauty of the system of guidance that Allah has created, that these individuals, whilst being Bashar, whilst being natural human being, they also guided, especially there. So things have to work.
The aim is not to use extraordinary powers to guide the people and to perform these roles. The whole purpose is that we want to perform these roles and let it flow in the natural way. So the means that the imams would have to use to fulfill the needs of the Shias and the Ummah across these lands is through the natural means. Yeah.
Exactly. Second reality on the ground is that we have a presence of an oppressive rulers. Right? We have presence of oppressive rulers. So Bani Umayyah, which then becomes Bani Abbas. Right? In terms of oppressiveness, they're as bad as each other. If we can't say Bani Abbas is worse. Right? Tabari narrates about Hajjaj, right, Ibn al-Thaqafi, who was during the time of Banu Umayyah. This guy, Tabari mentions, Tabari is anti-Shia, he says, Hajjaj killed above 100,000 people. Right? Hajjaj is no joke, right? His prisons were filled with Shias. He would kill anybody, not because he was Shia, because perhaps he might have been a Shia, and he would kill him. Right? Hajjaj would count his obedience greater than the obedience of Allah. Clearly he says, right? My obedience comes before the obedience of Allah. The Banu Abbas and the Banu Umayyah, the amount of torture, the amount of imprisonment, the amount of killing that happens because you're a Shia. Now tell me, with this kind of situation, right? We're talking about that political authority. How can the Imam do all this? How can the Imam kind of teach? I mean, there's no space to teach over here. There's no space to the tarbiyah.
There's a lot of pressure for people to be able, and people normally would want to live a good life whilst at the same time being religious. So here, if religion is putting so much pressure on them, then their life is being compromised, and this is difficult for people to handle, right?
Exactly. So the political, so forget the social leadership of the Ahlul Bayt, right? The political leadership, that doesn't, not going to happen with Banu Abbas.
Nearly happened. And the few companions that they have, they're not going to be able to.
It nearly happened over, right? A few times during the lives of the 12th Imams. But like Banu Abbas and Banu Umayyah never allowed that to happen, right? You have a psychological warfare going around, right? The cursing of Amir al-Mu'minin up until very far, 5th Imam on, till 5th, 6th Imam, we've got the cursing of Amir al-Mu'minin happening, right? The fact that the Shias are minority, you know how much psychologically this is a burden and a barrier and an obstacle to growth. I mean, for some of us who live in certain parts of the world right now, in certain countries, we're a minority, we feel that, right? The tarbiyat of our children, how do we manage our identity, etc., is challenging, right? So the use of violence, I talk about the ideological warfare. One of the very important or very sad thing you would say that the Banu Abbas do is to cut the connection with the Ahlul Bayt, right? You find that across these periods of time, I mean, you've heard the stories of Imam Hassan Askari. They say, for example, the 11th Imam, if you were to want to meet him, you would have to meet him whilst he's walking between his house and the palace. You find about the 6th Imam as well, we also have the late Imams, 9th, 10th, 11th Imam, that a few times a week their house would be searched completely. We find that a few times a week they would have to go to the darbar of the Abbasi Khalifa to report of their activities. Can you imagine? The Imam would have to leave his house, go to the darbar and say, this has been the activity that we've been doing. That's how the connection was cut. These are later Imams. Even the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, let me mention a very interesting, I find this hadith is very interesting. This hadith is mentioned in Kharaj. It's a very interesting hadith. There's a guy who divorced his wife three times in one sitting, right? He gives talaq to his wife three times. And then guess what? Now what do? Right? When they calm down, anger goes away and that kind of stuff, they're like, okay, now what do we do? According to some of the madhahib, that's it. You can't go back to your wife, right? Even that period where you're allowed to go back, that's deleted. So they don't know what to do, and his wife tells him, you know what, go to Imam Sadiq. Look at this story, yeah? So go to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and let's see, he might have a solution for us.
Were these Shias?
We don't know if they're Shias or not. Very likely, right? At that time, Imam Sadiq is neither in Mecca, neither in Medina, nor in Kufa. So you know Imam Sadiq at some point is in Kufa, at some point is in Medina. At this point in time, he's exiled into a place called Hira. At this point, he's exiled into a place called Hira, right? This guy goes and finds Imam in Hira, and he finds that the Imam is in house arrest. Nobody goes in, nobody comes out. He's like, now what do I do? I came all the way to Hira, I can't even meet the Imam. Right there he sees a person who's selling cucumbers. Right? So he tells the guy, can I buy a cucumber? So the guy says, of course, how many kilos do you want? And he says, I want everything. Okay. By all means, buy everything. So he buys everything. Then he tells him, give me your clothes as well. He takes this guy's clothes as well. right? You can read the hadith on the screen. So he takes the guy's clothes as well, goes around the block a few times. Who wants cucumber? He wants cucumbers, right? To pretend he's a cucumber seller. As he comes close to the house of the imam, the door opens. The servant of the imam says, please come in. We want a few kilos of cucumber. He goes in and the imam tells him, ma ajwada ma tamalta. Like, amazing what you did. Like, that was creative, bro. Like that, right? And then he says, okay, what do you want? So he tells him, look, I divorced my wife 3 times. I don't know what to do now. And the imam tells him, like, don't worry about it. Like, you can, she's halal for you. You can go back to her. He goes back, takes his clothes off, sells the rest of the cucumbers, and goes back home, right? Lesson one is how important certain ahkam are for the people. And how important it is for them to have this leader that they take to answer their problems, right? And how much they had to go through to just meet the imam for one simple question, one talaq question. It's not simple, obviously. It's a very important question. Yeah. But the point is that how much they would have to go through to go get one thing answered. So this is the time Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. We mentioned later on, like the later imams, right? 9, 10, 11. I mean, Imam Raza is completely detached from the Shias around Medina, Makkah, because he sent to Ma'arif in Tus.
What I find really interesting is that you mentioned Imam Sadiq, where the impression that we have is that Imam Baqir, Imam Sadiq was a time when it was so open. We discussed a bit with Shah Muhammad Baqir that it wasn't necessarily the case, but this example of yours shows that no, it was. Yes, true, there were periods of times in their lives where they were a bit more relaxed and they were able to preach more, but there was big times in their lives where they were really under pressure.
Yeah, definitely. So we talked about the 10th Imam, 11th Imam spending, Imam Qadim as well, spending so much time in prison, for example, right? Detached completely from their companions. Very interesting, another hadith, this is in Al-Kafi as well. We find that a person from far land apart, if I'm not mistaken, it's from Misr, right? He comes to Surra Manra, right? Which is Samarra today, where the Imam Hassan Askari is. Whilst being in the same city as Imam Hassan Askari, he's still told, فَأَشَرْنَا عَلَيْهِ أَنْ يَكْتُبَ إِلَىٰ أَبِي مُحَمَّدٍ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. That whilst you're in the same city, just write a letter to him. Right? You can't communicate straight to the Imam. Right? So you see how even though you're in the same city, you can't communicate to the Imam so easily. Right? So now, how can all the rules that we talked about, right, of the Imam doing teaching, protecting, doing tarbiyah, being hujjah, how can that happen? You can't really do this. Another thing that happens right on the ground is that there's a strong attacks on the beliefs of the Shias, right? Very strong. We know for a fact that there is ja'al of hadith, right? That hadith are fabricated. But we don't deny that, right? There is so many different sects that are created, right? Like some things are very. I mean, when we talk about history, we have to realize that yes, the argument right now sitting over here is very easy for us to say, okay, we have all the hadith, etc. But on the ground at that time, things are very challenging, right? Because you have these big enemies out there that want to really spread, and you have the dunya that's very attractive, and you have all these different factors that really make things go really difficult for people, right? Waqif that happens after the death of the 7th Imam. It's a very big deal. How Imam Sadiq moves his imamah to Imam Qadim is a very challenging period. Right? The Ismaili happens, and after Ismail, the sons of Ismail, that the son of Ismail, right, he goes into the Darban and complains about Imam Qadim, his own uncle. Right? Imam Ridha happens, Imam Jawad happens, you have so many different things. You have ideological things about the Ghulat, right? About the Mahdaviyat of Imam Qadim, about the Imamat of Ismail, about the uprising of Shahid al-Fakhr. You have the uprising of Zayd. You have so many different uprisings. Then you have the Sufis. Then you have the fake Sufism. Then you have the whole discussion about with the Mu'tazali and the Ash'ari. You have the Bani Umayyah and the Banu Abbas over here propagating predestinate Jabr. You have all these books that are coming from different other outside of the Arab land being translated in Arabic. You have arguments with the Zindiq and the Christians and the Jews. Like, it's a
ideologically whole, it's a big chaos.
It's a big, I won't say chaos, it requires something, right? The Imam on his own, okay, with all the things that are happening, he can't do what he's supposed to do, right? Alone like this. And then that's on the belief side. Then you have the moral degradation. I mean, Yasser, you won't believe it. This is very interesting. We find in history, let me just mention over here. You find in history, right, that around the time, with this we talk about beginning of the second century, right? So 114. So this is around Imam Baqir's time, right? Imam Baqir passed 114. 110, there's an incident that happens in Medina in the year 110. They say at that time there were around four very famous singers. Amongst them was this guy called Hunayn ibn Bulu', right? Hunayn ibn Bulu' lives in Iraq. He comes to Medina for a concert. We're talking about music over here. We're talking about singing, a concert. He comes to Medina for a performance. History says that people gathered so much on the streets and on the rooftops of the houses to see this guy, right, in his concert, that the houses fell and he died in that incident, that guy. The thing that you learn from this is that this is Medina, the city of revelation, okay, just a century after. The people will not come, 10 of them, to listen to the hadith of the imam, okay, but the entire city will gather for a concert. And we have so many different things. Let me give you another example. Ibrahim ibn Sa'id Zuhri, right? This is at the time of Harun Rashid. He's a scholar, recognized scholar, right? Not the Shias. He comes to Baghdad and Harun says, come, I want you to narrate hadith. He says, I will come with one condition. And that is that you have musicians and music in the darbar when I come. This is the facade, right? I mean, I haven't brought the alcohol and the gambling and the womanizing and these things that are happening openly in these cities. And scarily, Medina and Makkah, which are the cities of revelation, a century later, Medina is very different from what the Prophet would
have. This really highlights the importance of having of the leadership, how it affects the deen of the people, and which is why we've said many times that for Allah's guidance to be widespread and really established in people, the imam has to be the leader of the society. Otherwise, these kind of things basically happen. Yeah.
And this is why, for example, during time Imam Sajjad, for example, Imam Baqir as well, you find that they have a lot of emphasis on zuhd, right? And what they define as zuhd is like detachment from this world, from the haram world, because they see that one of the most sad things that happen in these cities amongst the believers is this facade, right? This attachment to this world. Because obviously the empire has now grown and money has come with it, right? And all the facade with it comes with it as well. So again, with that kind of environment, right, difficult to do the role that they're supposed to be doing. And last is the coming of the ghaiba, which inshallah we'll talk about later as well. The point being, this is the point of all this discussion, is that if you take this role of the imam on the left and you play the reality on the ground, okay, one man sitting in Medina or in Kufa cannot do this with the reality of this ground.
Yeah.
Right? And this is why, you ask the question, why this network? This is the very reason why it's necessary for the imam to establish a system, an organization, right, which will be able to do the work of the imam.
Hmm. This is going very, very well hand in hand with what Sheikh Kazim mentioned, that one of the duties we have at the time of ghaiba is the when the imam comes, is the nusra of the imam, the helping the imam. And we have in the Quran where Prophet Isa says, "Man ansari ilallah." So this idea that the Prophet cannot fulfill his task on his own, he needs that help. So this idea of Nusra and helping the Imam is not just for us related to our Imam, Imam Mahdi at the time of Zuhur, and because in Zuhur he wants to do this. This is a principle that applies to the Prophet and all the Imams for them to carry out their job.
Exactly. And so in this session, the next session, what we'll show over here is that the Imam established a system, right? Call it the network of representatives, right? The Wukala system, whereby the imam runs an organization. Now, this is underground because we have these oppressive rulers, right? So it has to be kind of secret. So he runs an underground network of individuals, okay, who will be spread across the, I was going to say the globe, across the empire at that time at least, right? Doing the work of the imam, but all of it is under the supervision of the imam. And you will see it's so beautiful that the imam, despite being in prison at times, despite all the pressure from the Abbasid Khalifa, the imam has an eye on everything that's happening in his organization. Like the best of managers out there, right? Controlling the finances, controlling the individuals, controlling the disputes that happen, the fights that happen, making sure that people get their rights, people are guided, people are done tarbiyat of, khums is collected, and preparing for the hukuma to happen, preparing for the ghaiba to happen. All of this is a system that we want to talk about, inshallah.
That sounds really good. And inshallah, we'll be able to then, once have a good picture of this, link it to today's inshallah.
Inshallah. Right. So we move on to the second discussion now, which is the roles of the wukala. Yeah. So coming back to the roles of the imam, again, this is very important and crucial for us, right? Because as you said, the system of wukala is there to perform the role of the imam. Not saying that the imam is not doing his role, but the role of the imam happens through this system. This is a very important point, right? We're not saying the imam said, okay, you guys do it, I'm going to sit down. No. The work of the imam is happening through this system, right? Where within the system, this tarbiyah happens, this teaching happens, etc. So,
the this just brings to my mind that we a lot of time have this expectation that, oh, if the imam was here, I would just walk to his house and start speaking to him. This is practically not possible if right now 7 billion people want to speak to the imam. That doesn't work,
yeah,
right? So there has to be a sort of hierarchy through which we have to pass if you want to meet the imam.
Yeah.
So practically, just like the maraji, the same thing, right? Sometimes you complain, oh, why don't the maraji give us time? Well, they're human beings. They're limited by space and time.
Exactly.
Imams are in the same way, are limited by space and time. Their communication with their people is going to happen through intermediaries. And this is what the wukala basically
When we were young, we learned about this, that when the 12th Imam will come, people will take bay'ah from him, right, in Makkah. And you're all thinking, like, I'm going to be there the first, right? There's millions of people that want to go there as well.
Yeah.
I mean, right now you get 3 million in Makkah and there's no space after that, right? I remember when I was a child, I was like, okay, I have to get visa as well, right? And get flight. And like, we need to imagine that whole kind of a superhero cartoon kind of thing, right? This is a reality on the ground we're talking about. These are real individuals, right? Not neglecting the fact that they have used and have access to ilm ghaib and wala taqwin, etc., right? And we find that happening as well, right? But that's not the asl. That's not the way it should happen. We want things to happen naturally, right? With the free will of the people to decide.
I think that's the key thing, right? Because this whole thing allows the free will of the people to express itself, but also having the system itself is a tarbiyah of people. So you have people, because of being wakil, you choose the people who really deserve it to be the wakil or the representatives, and this is a tarbiyah for themselves at a higher level.
Exactly.
Obviously, if you're somebody close to the imam and you're given a big role by the imam, your growth will be higher than somebody who hasn't. What makes you deserve that is because you've already
worked on yourself
and now you need to go higher, so the imam gives you more tasks. So the whole process, not only is it to guide other people, but it's a guidance in itself for those who are involved.
It's really beautiful, really, really. I would encourage all of us to rethink about these things, and you find that it makes so much sense, and it gives you a new perspective on the role of the Ahlul Bayt as well, like who these imams were, right, and what were they doing. Like, it's amazing. So coming to the roles of the wukala, I'll mention a few over here. The first one is obviously teaching Islam. We find that the wukala of the Ahlul Bayt, the system, obviously primary role is to teach Islam. Secondly, they're also being a hujjah. I put these two together because you find that the hadith also point them at the same time as well, right? That whatever he says, I said it as well. You don't have to come back to me. Inshallah, we'll talk about this as well. Third one is removing confusion. You find that one of the roles of the wukala was that in times of confusion, okay, they were there. They would step up and solve the issues, right? We have some beautiful hadith, like when the imam passes away, the next imam is going to be decided. There's confusion, right? It's the wukala that come and say, look, this is going to happen. This is how it works, right? And they clear things out. People who were in confusion as well, they know who to go to as well. Obviously, me sitting in Qom, for example, me sitting in Khorasan, me sitting in Yemen, I don't have access to the imam. I don't know what's going to happen next, right? But I have a wakil of the imam who's just got a signed letter from the imam saying he's the wakil. I go to him and say, you tell me what's going to happen. And he's going to solve the confusion, basically. Fourthly, collecting Islamic funds. This is essential and a very big part. I mean, some people have even said that the system of wukala was mainly for this only, collection of funds. It plays a very important role in the whole system.
Was it really just for this?
No, it wasn't just for this, but because it's such a big role, and obviously it's kind of a primary role as well. I mean, people are more
sensitive about their money
and that kind of stuff. And obviously a system can't run without money, right? And so collecting funds, distributing funds was one of the big roles.
We often see the imams as being zahid and encouraging people for zuhud. So it doesn't match them having, you know, playing around with money.
Oh, you'd be surprised. You know, there's stories where they would go to the darbar of the khalifa and they would say, khalifa, we have two khalifas over here, right? One is you, one is Imam Kadhim. Why? Because the amount of money that the amount of zakat Imam Kadhim is collecting, like, you'd be surprised. Or some other companies will come, some other people will come to Basra and say, like, the house of Imam Kadhim or Imam Sadiq from Mashriq, Maghrib, from the east to the west, money is coming. Hmm. Right?
So the beauty is that despite having so much money and channeling so much money, they're able to keep that distance from attachment to the world.
Obviously,
they're so they're not attached to the world, but they're handling money for the right purpose and channeling it to the right place where they should be.
Because like any organization, you need money, right, to run, right? Mm-hmm. You need to channel funds in the right places, make sure that money is given to the people who are needy, the orphans, the shuhada's family, etc. And the whole system needs to run on money, inshallah. We'll talk about that in detail as well.
Yeah.
So collecting funds and distributing funds is one of the important roles of the wukala. Protecting the Shias, that's very important as well. Many of the times the Shia were in danger if they were to contact with the Imam, for example, or the lives in danger, and the wukala would come and protect them, right? And the stories of individuals like Ibn Yaqtin, for example, which we'll talk about him as well, and his position in the government is very, very crucial for the protection of the Shias during the time of Imam Kadhim alayhi salam. And lastly, is working towards the establishment of a government. We've said this time and time again, right? That the Ahlul Bayt are the Imams, and the Quran establishes the Imam as a leading a community, right? Establishing a just community, a just society, right? And this is the role of the Imam. And the system of wakalas, one of the big roles that they had was to prepare the grounds for that to happen. Now, they were not successful during the lives of the 12 Imams. But in the future, it'll be possible. Right, so this is the roles in brief that we want to talk about one by one, inshallah. Right, so the first role is teaching Islam. We find about Abdul Rahman ibn Hajjaj. Abdul Rahman ibn Hajjaj, what a personality. Subhanallah, this guy is an amazing companion of the 7th Imam, 8th Imam, and also at time of 6th Imam is there as well. So amazing personality, very big companion, a wakil of the Imam. He's one of the babs of the Imam as well, which we'll talk about what these words mean. It was one of the highest level wakil basically that you can have.
Isn't the word bab used in other meanings by other sects?
It is, but it comes from this.
Okay.
They've taken it from this. They've stolen it from this istilah that we have. And we find this istilah in this wording, this terminology in the Rijal books that we have.
Okay.
Basically, Bab means the door to the Imam, right? Because there are times where the Imam would say that don't come to me right now, okay? Because of the difficulties are happening, go through, everything has to happen through this person. And so this person was counted as a Bab, basically, because every work that you have with the Imam has to go through somebody, and that person becomes a Bab, basically. Mm-hmm. And he's the highest level of wakil that you can have.
And is that terminologies that were used and known at the time, or they coined later on?
They coined a bit later, yeah.
Okay.
We define in Rijali books that we have at the time of Sheikh Tusi before that, basically. Mm. But the term wakil is used. So there's research we've done. I didn't want to bring over here, but the words are used by the Imam themselves. And it's not just wakil. We have a few of them, right? We have a few terms that the Imams would use very carefully and obviously but with a lot of precaution. But wakil is one of them. Probably the more common one is wakil.
Okay.
So about Abdul Rahman ibn Hajjaj, Imam tells him, Abu Abdullah tells him, Imam Sadiq tells him that Ya Abdul Rahman, kallim ahl al Madina, fa inni uhibbu an yura fi rijal shi'ati mithluk. Abdul Rahman, speak to the people of Medina. Right? Kallim means like go and speak to them, explain to them the religion. Right? Obviously, Abdul Rahman being a Shia, he will talk about tashayyu, he will talk about the role of the Imam, he will talk about who the Imam is. He would explain to people the religion, right? Because Imam says, فَإِنِّي أُحِبُّ I love to see people amongst the Shias like you. So if you want a role model for us, Imam likes to see us be like Abdul Rahman ibn Hajjaj, right? We'll come to this person many times later on as well. He plays a very, very important role in many different circumstances. You have about Muhammad ibn Hakim. This again is in Kashi, where Muhammad says, "Kana Abu al Hasan ya'muru Muhammad ibn Hakim an yujalisa ahl al Madina fi masjid Rasulillah wa yukallimahum wa yukhasimahum." The Imam tells Muhammad ibn Hakim that I want you to go sit with the people of Medina, right, in the mosque of the Prophet, and talk to them and debate with them. This is very interesting. Right? Something we need to appreciate as well, that many times you need to debate with people. Right? This doesn't go against unity, by the way. Right? When it comes to unity, we're still united, right? But united not in falsehood, right? United with the same common enemy that we have, united in the Quran and the Prophet and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, united on many different aspects. But when it comes to things that we don't agree with, in a very polite and very respectful manner, we can debate with them. And the Imam tells him, yukhasimahum, debate with them, right? Interesting, he says them after he carries on, hatta kallamahum fi sahib al-qabr. Talk to them about the person in this qabr. Now this could refer to the Holy Prophet, or it could refer to the Khulafa as well. Well, a very beautiful incident where there's a big gathering that's happening in the house of Imam Hadi alayhi salam, right? People are having meetings. So one of the few periods where people can have meeting with Imam Hadi, there's a lot of in and out, basically. The hadith, you can read it. There's a lot of in and out. People are coming to meet Imam Hadi, etc. And the big guys are there. The big companions, the Imam are there. So the Wakala, the Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman is there, for example, right? So one group of companions and the Shia come to the Imam. And the Imam says, please sit down. Yunus ibn Rahman is there as well. And Hisham is there as well. And these guys, they complain to the Imam. They say, where we live, okay, they're from a far region. So where we live, we're called kafir, we're called zindik, we're called loads of different terms. Like, it's difficult to be Shia over there, right? And then he tells the Imam that what we did is that we sat down with Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman and Hisham, and we learned from them how to debate with these guys, right? And how to defend our religion and how to spread our true manhaj, that we shouldn't become influenced by them or change our religion. No, we learned about our religion from Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman, so we can debate with them and we can argue with them and defend our religion at least, right? And then they tell Imam Hadi that if what we know now and we argued was wrong, then you blame them. You blame Yunus ibn Rahman, right? Yeah. And if when kunna ala dalalin fahadhani adallana, if we are misguided right now, it's because of these guys. It's because of your companions, basically, your wakala, right? And famurna natrukuhu. Then you tell us and we'll stop going to them, basically, for help in this case. And Imam says, no, they've taught you the right things, and you carry on, and the hadith carries on, basically. Mm. So you find that their role of the ashab, these companions, was to teach others as well, so how you can defend your religion in your own regions as well. One of the things that they had to do, these companions of the Ahlul Bayt, these wukala, is also to remove the confusion as well, right? So, for example, after Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, so you happen during the time of Imam Sadiq, the later days of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, there's this whole confusion about who the Imam is after him, right? Because Ismail, his eldest son, some people, because of Ismail's personality, they take him as the Imam, right? But what happens, he dies before Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and so those who were really insisting and they wanted to become deviant, they took the son of Ismail and they said that he's the Imam. Why? Because Imamah does not pass from one brother to another brother, except at the time of Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein. Anyway, so and the confusion with the Bani Abbas as well, the Imam Sadiq, when he passes away, when Imam Sadiq passes away, the information that Imam Kadhim is the Imam for some small period of time has to remain hidden. Right, so companions know, they've been told about this as well, but they need to spread it very slowly, and it spreads in the underground system at the time it's established as well, right? But you can't spread out too much as well, and this is why, you know, there's a famous hadith about Zurara, right? That unfortunately people come and say, oh, Zurara didn't know his Imam, that kind of stuff. In fact, if you look at the hadith specifically, and it's mentioned by Saduq and in his books, the issue wasn't that if Zurara didn't know the Imam, the issue was that, is he allowed now to spread?
Spread that, yeah.
Right? He needs to find out. I need to go through, and that's why he sends a few messengers around and say, can you find out, are we allowed to reveal to people that Imam Kadhim is or not? Right?
In fact, about Zurara, there's different hadith about them, but when you look at it together, you come to realize that, no, he didn't actually doubt the who's the next Imam after them. This is something known. Like we've said previously, that the fact that there's 12 Imams, and usually the Imam has already told their companions at least who's the next Imam going to be, that wasn't a confusion then, yeah.
No, Zurara knew Imam Kadhim was the Imam. In fact, Mufaddal ibn Umar knew as well. So if you look at the hadith over here, so Mufaddal, by the way, is a great companion. Again, right, like those who make the Imams happy are these guys. Mufaddal is, again, he's highest levels of wakala. At one point, he's the only wakil for Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, that nothing comes to Imam Kadhim except through Mufaddal, right? Very high-placed scholar and wakil in the whole system. So he says, "Kuntu in the Abi Abdullah, I was with Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Fadakhal Abu Ibrahim, Imam Kadhim came in, wa huwa ghulam, while he was young. Faqala istawsi bihi wa dha' amrahu inda min tathiqu bihi min ashabik." The wasiyah the Imam has passed to this child, right, Imam Kadhim, and then Imam tells him, "Go and tell this to people that you trust." What does that mean? That in the system, underground system, right, those that are trustworthy, those you can tell them that Imam Kadhim is the Imam after me, right, from your ashab. So this is how these wukala, so Imam, it's Mufaddal, is the wakil of the sixth Imam and as well the seventh Imam as well. He is in charge of telling the people about the Imam of Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, but even that in a very specific way. After the seventh Imam as well, there's this whole sect of waqf that happens, right?
The waqfiyah.
So we'll talk about that later. Inshallah, we'll talk about the issues that happen in the system. So obviously the system is not foolproof. We have issues in the system as well because we're dealing with non-ma'asum as well.
Yeah.
So there will be mistakes in the system naturally, and we'll talk about those mistakes and how the imam managed these mistakes. One of the things that happens in the system is that after the seventh imam, there's certain of the wakils of the imam that actually hold on to some money. They've got a lot of money with them that they've collected from zakat. Imam Kadhim passes away, the shahada of Imam Kadhim happens, and these guys, they claim that Imam Kadhim is the Mahdi in order to keep the money for themselves.
Mm.
Right? So in this very beautiful story about Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman, he says that Mata Abu Ibrahim, that when Imam Kadhim passed away, لَيْسَ مِنْ قُوَّامِهِ أَحَدٌ إِلَّا وَعِنْدَهُ الْمَالُ الْكَثِيرُ. Quwam is wakil. Another word for wakil in the hadith is quwam, right? So he says that they were not those wakil except that they had malul kathir with them. They had a lot of money with them, right? And this is what he says, kana thalika sababul waqfihim. This is why they did this waqf. They stopped at Imam Kadhim. He said there's no Imam after Imam
Basically,
Kadhim.
Basically, the greed for the world led them to let go of their beliefs.
Yeah. And then he describes who they were, right? And how much they had, etc. He goes and spreads the truth. He's a wakil of the imam. He goes and spreads the truth, right? فَلَمَّا رَأَيْتُ ذَلِكَ وَتَبَيَّنْتُ الْحَقِّ. I did bayan of the haq, right? وَعَرَفْتُ مِنْ أَمْرِ أَبِي الْحَسَنِ الرَّضَى. And I knew that Imam Rida was the imam. مَا عَلِمْتُ تَكَلَّمْتُ وَدَعَوْتُ النَّاسِ إِلَيْهِ. That which I knew, I went and spoke to the people about it, right? I told the people, this is my role as wakil in the system. I have to go and spread and remove the confusion. My responsibility, my role is this, right? When this happened, unfortunately, these guys, they called him and said, look, let me give you some money. How much money do you want? We'll give you. Can you please be quiet? Right? So we're trying to buy him off, basically, and quiet him. فَأَبَيْتُ وَقُلْتُ لَهُمْ إِنَّا رُوِّنَا عَلَى أَنِ الصَّادِقِ. That he said, no, I'm not going to take it. And he reports from the imam, and the story carries on. So this is one strong wakil who, in times of confusion, because the people are confused, right? And naturally, they'll be confused when you have people like Abu Hamza al-Bata'ini, right, who is known as a big figure, right? When he does this, people get confused naturally, right? The Shias at that time get a lot of them get confused, right? And this is not the only sect that happens at the time of Imam Kadhim, right? And so the confusion, who is in charge of removing this confusion?
Again, the wukala,
right?
This is an important point for us to also learn before we quickly go for a break. Just because somebody has reached a certain station doesn't mean that they can't go back on their steps, right? It's a warning for us as well that just because we have this ma'rifah and this love for the Ahlul Bayt doesn't mean that we can't go back. So before we continue on this, I think let's take a short break. And then we'll come back. So brothers and sisters, we can get some refreshments and get ourselves energized again for a more fruitful second part, inshallah. So we'll be back in a few moments.
Courses, articles, short posts, and inspirational videos. You'll find all your Islamic educational needs in one place. And that's here. At Babu Rida's online learning platform, we aim to provide all our Muslim brothers and sisters with the necessary knowledge of Islam to satisfy their intellectual thirst. Let's make a quick tour of the platform so you can be familiar with the content and how to access it. So firstly, you have the courses. If you just click here, you'll come to the courses page where you can see all of the courses we have so far. We have divided Islamic subjects into 6 general categories, and some courses which combine a few topics are featured under the general category. you can filter the courses according to their categories. Just click on any course of interest and you can enroll to the course and start immediately. To access any course though, you have to have registered on the website. Don't worry, it's free and it's quick. Each course has a few lessons and some MCQs just to help you make sure you've caught the important points. Some courses need prerequisites because they rely on information learned from other courses. This feature is to help structure your learning and building your knowledge on strong foundations. You can also take notes by clicking on the small icon over here, and you can view all your notes over here. Basically, this is a full study platform which we've adapted to making online learning be more constructive and appealing. Most courses are self-paced, so you can do them in your own time, pause when necessary, and re-listen to parts where you feel the need to. There are many more courses coming, so always keep an eye out on the website and on social media. We'll keep you posted. And then we have a series of articles over here. Some articles, because of the depth of the content, have explanatory videos which make the difficult parts easier to grasp. Other articles also come with an audio format, so you can listen to them in your car or when you're just out and about. All this was strong learning material, but we also have lighter content, which serve as reminders, inspirations, and motivations. That's the blogs and short video sections, which cover a wide range of topics and sometimes related to different occasions of the year. Just go through these two lists and also check out the playlists on our YouTube channel. If you face any issues or have any suggestions, simply contact us and we'll get back to you. So here you go, this is Babur Rida's online learning platform. Happy learning!
السلام عليك يا حجة الله في أرض السلام عليك يا عين الله في خلق السلام عليك يا نور الله الذي يهتدي به المهتدون ويفرج به عن المؤمنين السلام عليك أيها المهذب الخائف السلام عليك أيها الولي المنصر السلام عليك أيها المهذب الخائف السلام عليك أيها الولي المنصر السلام عليك يا سفينة النجاة السلام عليك يا عين الحياة يا عين الحياة
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, welcome back to the session. We're with Sheikh Miqdad discussing a very important topic of the system of representatives that was established by the Imams to carry out their roles as guides, as murabbis, those who do tarbiyah of the people, and so on. So we're in the middle of discussing how the companions' role of teaching is being described in the different riwayat.
So we were talking about removing confusion, and we saw how after the sixth Imam and the seventh Imam, the confusion was removed by the wukala. Same thing happens after the ninth Imam and the tenth Imam as well. I won't mention the details right now, but you can find this in hadith. So for example, in Al-Kafi, you have this hadith whereby the people get together in the house of the wukala, right? To establish the imamah of the 10th Imam, and how then they bring two witnesses, and there's a whole story behind it, basically. The point over here is that the wukala got together to discuss this very together and to help the Shias understand and the continuation of the imam. One of the important roles of the wukala as well is to be a hujjah as well of the time. Yeah. By being a hujjah,
what does this mean? Because being a hujjah seems to be something specific for the imams.
So no, in fact, you find that it is specific for the imams, right? But how the imam's hujjah comes, right? It's expressed through the wukala, the companions, right? Not the entirety, obviously. And just like the teaching as well, doesn't happen entirety. Obviously, what the people say and what the imam says is different, right? But the work of the Ahlul Bayt, keep emphasizing this, the work of the Ahlul Bayt that they do as imams happens through the companions, happens through a system, and very organized and managed system. So for example, you find that Ishaq ibn Sa'd al-Qummi. So Ishaq ibn Sa'd al-Qummi is a great companion, right? A companion of the 10th Imam, 11th Imam. Mm-hmm. He is this mosque that we have as well that I went to visit, inshallah, I'll show a video very soon. I went to visit... It's been said that it's under the instruction of the 11th Imam to Ishaq ibn Sa'd, great companion, like big companion, right? دَخَلْتُ عَلَى أَبِي الْحَسَنِ عَلِي ابْنِ مُحَمَّدِ صَلَوَاتُ اللَّهِ عَلَيْهِ فِي يَوْمِ مِنَ الْأَيَّامِ. He enters upon Imam Hadi alayhi salam. فَقُولْتُ يَا سَيْدِ, he tells him, أَنَا أَغِيبُ وَأَشْهَدُ وَلَا يَتَّهَيَّأُ لِيَ الْوُصُولِ إِلَيْكَ إِذَا شَهِدْتُ فِي كُلِّ وَقْتٍ. Basically, complains the Imam of being absent from the presence of the imam and not being able to benefit from the imam, right? At this point, the imam tells him, فَقَالَ لِي صَلَوَاتُ اللَّهِ عَلَيْهِ هَذَا أَبُو عَمْرُ. Abu Amr is Uthman ibn Sa'd, right? Uthman is the highest companion that Imam Hasan Askari has, who then also becomes the first naib of the 12th imam, right? Big guy. But imagine, like, Ishaq has been told, go to Uthman. Look at what the imam says. He is thiqa. Al-Amin. مَا قَالَهُ لَكُمْ فَعَنِّي يَقُولُهُ. Whatever he says, it is from me. It's as if I have said. This is this being that, right? That whatever he says, you take it as if it's taken from me. This is a hujjah, right? You can't say, oh, but I didn't have access to the imam, so I couldn't get to him, therefore I couldn't go to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, therefore I sinned.
No, you can't. Imam has made it clear that if you go to him, it's like you've come to me.
Basically. Exactly.
And right. Your hujjah is complete.
And you find this throughout many different people. So for example, this is very interesting. A group of companions, they come to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. فَقَالُوا أَقِمْ لَنَا رَجُلًا نَفْزَعُ إِلَيْهِ فِي أَمْرِ دِينِنَا. Place from amongst us a people that we can refer to for our affairs in the religion. وَمَا نَحْتَاجُ إِلَيْهِ مِنَ الْأَحْكَامِ. That which means the ahkam. And the Imam places for them who? Places for them Mufaddal. Mufaddal ibn Umar. Right? And look what he says about Mufaddal. إِنَّهُ لَا يَقُولُ عَلَى اللَّهِ وَعَلَيَّ إِلَّا الْحَقِّ. He doesn't say about Allah and about me except that which is truth. Right? Very interesting about Mufaddal. You find about Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman, same thing as well. So, قُلْتُ لِيَعْبِ الْحَسَنِ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. So Ali ibn Yaqtin. So Ali ibn Yaqtin is a great companion of the 7th, 8th Imam. He says, I told the 8th Imam, جُعِلْتُ فِدَاكَ. إِنِّي لَا أَكَادُ أَصِلُ إِلَيْكَ. I don't come to you very often. It's very difficult for me to come to you, right? If I need something in my ma'alimi dini, in my teaching of my understanding of the religion, where do I go to? Is Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman thiqa and can I take what I need from him? And the Imam says yes. Point blank. The Imam says, doesn't say, oh, but if he says something that go against me, says you take from him. This shows the position of Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman, right? That Ali ibn Yaqtin, if you want to ever know something about your religion, go to Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman. Yunus is a big companion, right? Come to Zakir ibn Adam. A person by the name of Ali ibn Musayyab, he goes to Imam Rida alayhi salam, right? Qutu li Rida alayhi salam, that he comes from a very far place, right? He says, Lastu asilu ilayka fi kulli waqt. I can't come to you all the time, right? فَمِمَّنْ أَخُذُ مَعَالِمَ دِينِي. So where do I get my religion from? How am I going to learn about Islam, about the ahkam, who's going to be my tarbiyat, etc.? فَقَالَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. Imam Rida tells him, مِنْ زَكَرِ ابْنِ آدَمَ الْقُمِّي الْمَأْمُونَ عَلَى الدِّينِ وَالدُّنْيَا. Right? Go to Zakariya ibn Adam, who is going to save you, okay? And he's a preserver of the deen and the and the dunya. Right? And he says, فَلَمَّا انصرفت, when I returned back, I went to Zakiya ibn Adam and got everything that I wanted. I went to him for my hajat. Zakiya ibn Adam is a very special person, right? It is said about him that once he tells Imam Ridha alayhi salam that إِنِّي أُرِيدُ الْخُرُوجَ عَنْ أَهْلِ بَيْتِي فَقَدْ كَثُرَ السُّفَهَاءُ فِيهِمْ. He lives in Qom, right? And he says, like, it's becoming difficult for me, right? He's a very high-level expert in science, in religion, sciences, right? And obviously it's difficult for him to live amongst people that don't understand so much. So he tells Imam, I want to come next to you. Can I come to Medina? Just I can speak to you. We can talk about different things. I learn from you. فَقَالَ The Imam says, لَا تَفْعَلْ Don't come. Right? I want you to stay in Qom. Right? Why? فَإِنَّ أَهْلَ بَيْتِكْ يُدْفَعُ عَنْهُمْ بِكَ That the bala, right? That the difficulties is prevented from this city, from the people around you, because of your presence. كَمَا يُدْفَعُ عَنْ أَهْلِ بَغْدَاد بِأَبِي الْحَسَنِ الْقَادِمِ Just the way that the bala from the people of Baghdad was removed from them because of the presence of Imam Qadim alayhi salam. It's a huge statement to make from the Imam Ridha alayhi salam about Zakiya ibn Adam. So recently, you know where he's buried, right? Zakiya ibn Adam, he's buried in Qom.
Yeah.
So recently I went to visit his grave, and can I show the viewers about me going to the grave of Zakiya ibn Adam? It's an opportunity to visit such an amazing personality, very amazing personality amongst the wakala, and definitely a wakil responsible for many different tasks in Qom and around the region as well.
For those who come to Ziyarat for Qom, normally we only go to the shrine of Sayyidah Fatima, which is really important, but we fail to realize that there's a lot of other personalities around that are really important and that we should pay attention to. Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum. So welcome to Qom. I'm here next to the Haram of Bibi Ma'suma alayha salam. As you can see, this is the Haram of Bibi Ma'suma alayha salam. Assalamu alayki ya bint Rasulullah. As you come across this side as well, very quickly, you find the mosque. Which is called the Imam Hassan Askari Mosque, attributed or built by the instruction of the 11th Imam to his wakil called Ahmad ibn Ishaq. And as we walk over here, I want to take you to a very, very beautiful graveyard called Shaykhan. Inside Shaykhan, there is a very amazing personality buried there. So let's go together to this graveyard. Assalamu alaikum ya ahl al-diyar min al-mu'mineen wal-mu'minat. Over here is the very old graveyard of the city of Qom called Shaykhan. In this graveyard, there's a few companions of the Ahl al-Bayt that are buried over here. So these two graves that you see in front of you is two companions. One of them is the brother of Zakariya ibn Adam and also the teacher of Barqi. As we come over here, I want to take you to the grave of Zakiya ibn Adam. So Zakiya ibn Adam is amongst the wukala of the 8th Imam, holds a very high position in the eyes of the Imam. Very, very amazing personality. So the Imam Ridha says about Zakiya ibn Adam that the city is safe because of you. This is the grave of Zakiya ibn Adam, the wakil of the 8th and the 9th Imam. Very, very amazing personality. So these two graves are the graves of two companions of Imam Sadiq, Imam Qadim. This is Zakiya ibn Idris, Ash'ariya Qummi. And this is Adam ibn Ishaq, Ash'ariya Qummi. They're related to Zakiya ibn Adam. And the brother of Zakiya ibn Adam is also the teacher of Barqi, the famous scholar and reporter of traditions. There is also in this graveyard plenty of amazing ulama that are buried here, shuhada. Some very, very ancient graves over here. There's one grave over here that I'd like to show before I cut, inshallah. And this is the grave of Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Maliki Tabrizi, the famous Arif, the student of Sayyid Qadi. So that's all from us, inshallah. I hope you enjoyed a small tour to visit the grave of Zakiya ibn Adam. We hope that, inshallah, we can be like him for the Ahlul Bayt, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Right, so I hope you enjoyed that, inshallah. Moving on, the other responsibility of the system of wakala, this underground system, is the collection of funds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we talk about collection of funds, we're talking about zakat, khums, nadr, right? Some people want to do nadr, for example, that if I do certain, if certain thing happens to me, then I will give certain amount of money, for example, to the imam, for example, right? And we find stories like this where people will do nadr, right? And their wish will be accepted, and this would have to pay the imam, the money to the imam, etc. We find that there's collection of waqf money as well, right? The system of waqf, which we, inshallah, we'll talk about. And obviously gifts, people would send gifts to the imam. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody can't come to the imam. We talked about the collection of khums and zakat cannot happen so openly. It cannot
it's
happen.
It's very sensitive. When it comes to money, it's very sensitive. The government is involved, so it's quite a tough thing.
But despite all this, you realize that the amount of money that is coming in and out of the system is just spectacular. So Ali ibn Ismail is in Ghaybat of Tusi. Ali ibn Ismail ibn Ja'far, this is the son of Ismail, the son of Imam Ja'far Sadiq alayhi salam. He complains to Yahya ibn Khalid. Yahya ibn Khalid is the wazir of Harun Rashid. He tells him, قال له إن الأموال تحمل إليهم من المشرق والمغرب. Money is coming to him, talking about Imam Qadim alayhi salam, from east to west. Right? وَإِنَّ لَهُ بُيُوتَ أَمْوَالٍ And he has houses of money. Right? وَإِنَّهُ اشْتَرَى ضَيْعَةً بِثَلَاثِينَ أَلْفَ دِينَارٍ And he just bought a land with 30,000 dinar. 30,000 dinar is not a joke, basically. Right? This is how he's describing this system right now that Imam Qadim is managing.
Yeah.
We find, for example, in another riwayat in Kharaij, it's mentioned that مَا رُوِيَ عَنِ الْمُفَضَّلِ ابْنِ عُمَرٍ He says that حُمِلَ إِلَىٰ أَبِي عَبْدِ اللَّهِ مَالٌ مِّنْ خُرَاسَانٍ مَعَ رَجُلٍ مِّنْ أَصْحَابِهِ This is the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, right? We haven't come to the strong establishment of the system, 7th, 8th, 11th Imam, right? This is, at the time of Imam Sadiq, you have people coming from Khurasan to give their money to the Imam, right? This is how much, one, is so important, the collection of khums and zakat and other funds. And second, how people give importance to this, and it's important for it to come to the Imam. Because we know it has to be given to the Ahlul Bayt. So basically how the system works is that the wakil collects the funds. This is one important role of the wakil, is to collect funds, right? And then the second role is to either send it to the imam, right? And we'll talk about later on how these things work, how does the coming and the sending happens. But the role of the wakil is to take the money and send it to the imam, right? So people don't have to go to the imam themselves. They just give it to the wakil. Right? They will go to the daftar of the wakil, to the office of the wakil. Here's my khums. And the wakil will be responsible to send it to the imam. Or in certain circumstances, with the instruction of the imam, the wakil will be allowed to distribute it himself. At times, even with a general permission. Right? Not with a specific... So the imam sometimes will tell him, like, I want you spending in this area specifically. Or sometimes the imam will tell him, you're allowed to spend. And he would decide where he think would be best spent.
Okay. So having seen that the system is so underground, how do the Shias know who this is? And why is there nobody revealing that, okay, amongst the Shias, was there no betrayal that happened that, obviously, it was known that this is the wakil, he's taking money. So, report him to the, get a bit of money in exchange.
Betrayal happened. Blood was spilled. Right, people had to die for the protection of the Shias, for the protection of the system. And this is when we talk about, later on we'll talk about taqiyya, how the being secretive is so important over here, because people have died for this, right? I'll say this right now and I'll repeat this later as well. Dr. Rafi was saying in one lecture, today you take your phone with a press of a button, you open a hadith from Musul al-Kafi, you press a button, you open the Quran. This has come to you, blood has been spilled for this. People had to die and go through so much trouble for us to be today sitting over here and have access to the ocean of knowledge of the Ahlul Bayt. It didn't come as free of charge. We have to appreciate this. And sometimes it really, really hurts me when people come and says, oh, but this guy, this companion, oh, he was this and he was that. Like, we have to have a bit of respect. Yes, people made mistakes, right? But you can't just tell a person, oh, this guy was this sect, for example, forget about him, right? Or they use bad terms about him. I have to realize that for us to be sitting over here and be judging the situation so easily, so quickly, is kind of ignorant of our behalf and very unfair for us to do that.
Hmm.
We'll talk about that inshallah later on. Okay. But yeah, the system was secretive. Yes, there were betrayal happening.
People but the Shias knew who the representative was.
They would find out, basically. When the time would come, they would find out somehow, okay, asking different people. So we have to go through a lot of chains. And you find that they would go through a lot of difficulties, right? Sometimes they would have to travel different cities, meet the wakil. they would ask somebody, okay, do you know what the wakil is? And then he would say, okay, ask this person, he might know, and that person might know, and finally they would get to the wakil, and they would tell the wakil, can I go to meet the imam? The wakil would know, right? Sometimes they would have to check with the wakil, so the people were also told by the imam that you also be sure who you're giving the money to. You know why? Because there were false wakils. People who are greedy for money, okay, oh, by the way, I'm a wakil as well.
False claimants, yeah.
So we find there's a list of individuals by name that we have, right, that claim to be wakil. Right? And how the imam managed this? He told the people, okay, this is what you need to do. Right? When you give the money, make sure that you know who the wakil is. Make sure you have a letter from me that's been signed, etc. We'll talk about the khat of the imam, the writing of the imam, the stamp of the imam. Inshallah, we'll talk about all this in the right time.
Inshallah.
Talking about zakat, so the imams would collect zakat. So as you know, the zakat goes to the imam, right? The difference between zakat and khums is in this, that the zakat is the property of Baytul Mal. Right, to me, it becomes like a normal tax that we pay, where tax is spent on the growth of the society, whether it's schools or roads, etc. It's called kharaj as well, and it's got different terminologies as well. And in the establishment at that time, okay, the tax will go to the Banu Abbas, Banu Umayyah, then Banu Abbas, right? But still, the Shias, they would have to pay the zakat to the Ahlul Bayt, unless there was a reason why they would be told, okay, you can pay, or there will be different circumstances, which we don't want to go into details right now, right? So the zakat would have to be, and people would be paying the zakat to the imam as well, right? And this is why you find that the amount of money that comes to the imam, the terms many times you use is zakat, right? The whole waqf that happens, the term over there is that they had loads of money from zakat, right? So for example, in this hadith, from a kashi, where one person complains to Harun, he says, "Qala ya Amirul Mu'minin, khalifatan fil ard." Tells Harun, "There's two khalifa on the earth, right? Musa ibn Ja'far bil Madina yujba lahu al kharaj, wa anta bil Iraq yujba lak al kharaj, right? In Medina, there's Imam Qadim, he collects zakat, and you over here in Iraq are collecting zakat."
And money is power, basically, right? So.
Exactly. You know, there's one thing I mentioned over here as well, shall we come back. The one of the reasons why the Ahlul Bayt was so much under torture, prison, taken away, it's because of their power they were getting. The Khalifa, you know, authorities are never scared of a person who prays in the mosque and is giving teaching about the Quran. Right? That's not very fearful. I mean, you can do that on your own. Today is happening as well. The fear about the Ahlul Bayt is because of what they were doing really, which was a threat to the government, right? The power that they had, the influence that they had, the voice that they had. And all this was happening through what? To the system of Wakala. Anyway, so the Imam is collecting zakat, right? Such that this person comes to the Imam, comes to Harun and says, "Look, Harun, there's two khalifa on the earth right now. You and Imam Qadim alayhi salam." Another shahid, another way to show you that zakat was collected. So Yunus ibn Ya'qub comes to Imam Ridha alayhi salam and he asks him a question. "U'tiha ula'i alladhina yaz'umun anna abaka hayyum min az-zakat shay'a." Are we allowed to give zakat to those people who claim that your dad is still alive? So the waqf. So people who remain in the sector of waqf, who stopped at Imam Qadim, okay? He's asking a genuine question. So now I have zakat. Can I? Because zakat goes back to the, is paid for the believers, right? For their expenses, for the poor people, etc. Asking a question, if there is someone who's a waqfi, right? Am I allowed to give zakat to him? What does this show to us? That the zakat is collected and distributed by the Ahlul Bayt, right? In the system of wakala.
Yeah.
This is in Keshi. So this was about zakat. Now we come to khums. So khums, again, is another form of tax. Now the difference between zakat and khums, I said, khums is the property of the Ahlul Bayt, right? So the Quran says, وَعْلَمُ أَنَّمَا غَنِمْتُمْ مِنْ شَيْءٍ فَأَنَّ لِلَّهِ خُمُسَهُ. What you have of ghanimat, what you have of surplus. Now, ghanimat could mean the war booty, right? Or it could mean any surplus from different things, right? However much you want to interpret this hadith, this verse, whatever it means, okay? Both Sunnis and Shias agree that we have khums on more than war booty. Even the Ahl Sunnah agree on this, right? From their own hadith, etc. Just that they don't know where to spend it right now and how to collect it. Because the verse says, فَأَنَّ لِلَّهِ خُمُسُهُ, because a fifth of it, right, 20% belongs to the Allah, وَلِلْرَسُولِ وَلِذِ الْقُرْبَ, right? And لِذِ الْقُرْبَ, it's agreed upon on both schools of thought, that the ذِ الْقُرْبَ are the Ahlul Bayt, right?
Okay.
The Hazrat Amir and Bibi Fatima and the children from the progeny of Hazrat Zahra.
Okay.
So there's no doubt about this. So the difference between Khums and Zakat is that Khums is the personal property of the Ahlul Bayt. It belongs to them. Right? And this is a very important distinction because therefore the because it's their own money, they could, for example, say, okay, I don't want it, it's okay. Right? Mm-hmm. And very interesting, we find these certain hadiths like this as well. So one person, for example, he comes, it's a wakil of the Imam, right? I mentioned here, I'll come back to it as well. These stories are so nice. I think this one not particularly, but so he comes to the Imam and he comes to the Imam and tells him that I had 20,000 of Khums money, I spent it. Is it possible for you to do halal, please? Like, and the Imam says, okay, fine. Like, because it's his own money, he can do that.
He can allow himself to
right?
do that.
Okay. So it's like, okay, fine, it's halal for you. But then he tells him, right? When the person leaves, he tells the companions that he'll have to answer for it though. I made it halal for him, but you have to answer, where did he spend it? Right? Khums is not a joke. And so you find that Khums as a property of the Ahlul Bayt was collected, and there is plenty of evidence that Khums was collected by the Ahlul Bayt within the system of Wakala. Okay. The question is, if it's a property of the Ahlul Bayt, why would they collect Khums? And we find this hadith very clear from the Prophet, so from the Ahlul Bayt. So for example, the Imam in this hadith says, "Inni la akhudhu min ahadikum dirham." Right? The Imam is taking from them this Khums, saying that, look, I'm amongst the people who have a lot of money. The reason I'm taking money from you is not because I need it. I'm not a poor person to take from you. Rather, illa an tutahharu. I'm doing this, taking khums, to purify you. This is what the Quran says, right? The Quran is very clear. It says that it tells the Prophet, take the sadaqah from the people, you zakihim, right? So they're purified. Imam Jawad, in a letter to his wakil, Ali ibn Mahziyar, about the details about how to collect khums, etc., it's a long letter mentioned by Sheikh Tusi in Tahdhib. He says, فَأَحْبَبْتُ أَنْ أُطَهِرَهُمْ وَأُزَكِيهِمْ. I'm doing this, collecting the khums, because I want them, I love them to be pure and tazkiyah of. In a lengthy letter of Imam Hasan Askari to the Shias of Nishapur, again, the concept I mentioned at the beginning, right? Azwajikum wa amwalikum, what you eat and what you drink, right? All of it becomes halal because of what? Right? Because I take this khums from you, right? The reason why your money is halal is because of khums. I remember this story, well, just in bracket, just to... There's a person that comes to Imam Khomeini and he gives khums to Imam Khomeini in a very arrogant way, like, you know, I've got so much money, I'm giving you a bit, right? The Imam says, that attitude basically doesn't want to take the khums. He says, you keep it basically. And just know that if I don't take it from you, everything that you eat, everything you eat is all haram for you. Right? This is what the Imam is saying. Like, if I take khums, then your maal becomes halal. Your children become halal. That which you drink and eat, etc., becomes halal. We find that the system of wakala would collect khums, therefore. So, for example, you have, and amongst the big responsibility that they had was to collect these funds. So, Imam Hasan Askari's letter to Abdullah ibn Hamdaway, he says that, فَقَدْ نَصَبْتُ لَكُمْ إِبْرَاهِيمِ ابْنِ عَبْدَهِ. So, Ibn Abdah is one of the wakala of the 11th Imam. Over here, the Imam appoints him. نَصَبْتُ لَكُمْ. Right? I am appointing for you Ibrahim as your wakil. Why? ليدفع إليه النواحي وأهل ناحيتك حقوقي الواجب عليكم. So that you give to the wakala and you pass through him basically what? My right that is wajib upon you. And this is what? What's my right? It's the khums basically. Right? وجعلته ثقتي وأميني عند موالي هناك. And he's a person that's reliable and a trustworthy person is amongst you basically. The letter carries on. It's a very beautiful letter. It's mentioned in Keshi. Imam Hadi's letter to the people of Baghdad and Madain and Sawad. So Baghdad, Madain and Sawad often comes as one region basically. When Ali ibn Hussein is replaced with Ibn Rashid. Ibn Rashid is a companion of the Imam. And he replaces the previous wakil.
Which Imam are we talking about here?
Imam Hadi alayhi salam. Inni aqamtu Aba Ali ibn Rashid. I'm appointing for you this wakil, his name is Ali ibn Rashid, maqam Ali ibn al-Hussein, in the place of Ali ibn al-Hussein. وَمَنْ كَانَ قَبْلَهُ مِنْ wakala, and all the previous wakala as well. So they're all deleted now. They're not there as wakil. The one that wakil that I want to deal with now right now is Ibn Rashid. وَصَارَ فِي مَنْزِلَتِهِ عِنْدِي. And his manzil is my manzila. وَصَارَ فِي مَنْزِلَتِهِ وَصَارَ فِي مَنْزِلَتِهِ عِنْدِي. وَلَيْتُهُ مَا كَانَ يَتَوَلَّهُ غَيْرُ مِنْ وَكَلَاهِ قَبْلَكُمْ لِيَقْبِضَ حَقِّهِ. That which I want to come to is this one. He he has become and taken this position as the authority, etc. Why? So that you give my right to him, which is khums basically. And later carries on. Again, this is mentioned in Keshi. Again, the examples are very many. There's one very interesting example where about Zakir ibn Adam. I will come back to this later as well, but I'll mention over here very quickly, where two people come from the Imam, right, to Zakir ibn Adam in Qum to pick up his khums, to pick up the khums that he's collected, right? But he refuses to give it to them because there's a dispute between them. There's a dispute or there's a difference of opinion between them, or they kind of something is suspicious basically. So Zakir ibn Adam takes precaution, he doesn't give it to them, right? So they go back to the Imam and they complain that Zakaria didn't give the money. So he sends Ahmed ibn Muhammad ibn Isa to Zakaria ibn Adam, right? And tells, there's a doubt that happens about Zakaria. The Imam tells him, no, I trust Zakaria, don't worry. So he sends Ahmed ibn Muhammad to Zakaria ibn Adam. So go sort it out. So Ahmed goes to Zakaria and Zakaria tells him, like, there was something that made me suspicious, therefore I didn't give it to him. And so Ahmed says, no, I've got a letter now from the Imam, you have to give. And so he gives everything to the wakil. Again, showing that the money is collected even from place like Khums. Another riwayat, this is from Tahdib, from Sheikh Tusi, where there's kind of an explanation required for the people regarding Khums very specifically. So Imam Hadi al-Islam, Imam Hassan Askari al-Islam, writes a letter in which he explains about khums, where he says alayhi l-khums ba'da ma'unati, the khums is paid after your expenses, the expenses of your family and even the tax. So first pay the government tax, pay the family expenses, etc. You cover all your expenses, whatever remains has khums on it. This is explained in a letter to one of his wukala. Coming to the next type of fund that we collect, so we talk about zakat, we talk about khums. Another fund that is collected is waqf. So waqf, unfortunately, is something that we don't really pay attention to, but it's very, very important. So waqf is whereby a person comes and, so in English it's called endowment of, charitable endowment, right? So whereby you come and say, for example, this particular land, okay, I give it for, let's say, education, right? And then whatever is built over here, a school, etc., will be built in. So the land might still belong to me, but it's done waqf for a particular either purpose or individual. So even you can do waqf to people, for example. So for example, you do waqf of water, for example. So you say you place a tap, for example, in a street that doesn't have water, or a well, for example, and you do waqf of this to say, whatever is from this well, I do waqf of it to the people who come and drink from it over here. And so you can go and refer to the rulings of waqf. It's very important. Waqf is a very important aspect.
There's a certain way of doing it in there.
Yeah. And one of the aspects of this is that there has to be a trustee for this. So waqf can't happen without a trustee.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who is in charge of the waqf. And this goes back to the imam. The imam or the appointment, the wakil that the imam appoints. So you find that the imam would appoint wakala to be able to take care of the waqf. And interestingly, one place where a lot of waqf happens is in Qom. In fact, a lot of our houses over here are under waqf basically, because they belong to people and they're done waqf for a particular place, for example, for the haram, etc. Right? And so you find that the wukala amongst their responsibility was to do what? Was to take care of the wukuf. So for example, you have about Salih ibn Muhammad ibn al-Sahl, right? وَكَانَ يَتَوَلَّ لَهُ الْوَقْفَ بِقُمْ. So he was appointed by the Ahlul Bayt to be the trustee of the waqf in Qum, right? You have this very beautiful example about a person in Azerbaijan. This is the time of the 12th Imam in Ghaybat al-Sughra, where he is in charge of a waqf in that place. But interestingly, and there's a lot we can learn from this as well, is that he's allowed, with the permission of the Imam, to actually use the half of it for himself, for his own expenses, right? And when he passes away in his wasiyah, he writes to his son that this is how things work, basically. The story is long, but the point is that the waqf was happening in Azerbaijan, right, in this whole system whereby the wukala were in charge of this. The distribution of funds, so once you collect, funds are collected, then either the same funds is distributed, right, with the permission of the imam, either specifically in certain areas or general with the permission, but everything has had to happen with the permission of the Ahlul Bayt. And a lot of funds goes back to the Ahlul Bayt as well for their own expenses. And this is why you find that the Ahlul Bayt, obviously with the amount of generosity that they had, there's so many stories about them giving out money to different people, including enemies, including people that didn't like them. So the stories are plenty. I'm not going to mention them right now.
This sort of makes sense why we find that we have a hadith where it says, okay, somebody came to the Imam, Imam gave this much amount of money. We don't only have this picture, but Imams didn't have much money. Again, they were away from this world.
So this was so part of again, the whole system.
Yeah. So they were handling money, but then that detachment and all that.
And you find that the Imams were very particular about where the money is spent. Very, very particular. And they would spend it in the appropriate way that they had to. And they would give specific instructions, right? And on the other side as well, the wakala also were very like this as well, right? So you find, for example, in stories, you have stories where for example, if a wakil would lose a money, for example. So obviously they're traveling across lands, etc. If he would, by chance, lose a particular amount of money, he would actually put it back from his own pocket, right? Because they were very precautious, they had to make sure they bring exact money that they had collected back to the imam. I'll just say one interesting story. Abu Tahir ibn Bulbul says, I went to Hajj. فَنَظَرَ إِلَىٰ عَلِيَ بْنِ جَعْفَرَ الْحَمْيَانِ عَلِيَ بْنِ جَعْفَرَ الْحَمَانِ Ali ibn Ja'far is a wakil of the imam. And he says that, when I saw him in Hajj, هُوَ يُنْفِقُ النَّفَقَاتِ الْعَظِيمَةِ He was giving out money like really a lot. Like he was dishing money to the poor people in big amounts. So he says, I didn't say anything at that time, but I wrote a letter, كَتَبَ بِذَلِكَ إِلَىٰ أَبِي مُحَمَّدٍ Right, Imam Hassan Askari, I wrote a letter to him, complaining about this guy, like, what is this guy doing, spending so much money, right? The Imam writes back to him and says, no, this happened, كُنَّ أَمَرْنَا لَهُ بِمِئَةِ أَلْفَ دِنَارِ I actually gave him the money and I told him what to spend it like this, right? So you find a wakil, a placed wakil, spending money by the instructions of the Ahlul Bayt themselves. This is mentioned in Ghibat al-Tusi. There are different places where money was spent. One interesting place, two interesting places I'll mention over here. One of them is that we find in this concept as part of the role of the imam is to establish true justice. And true justice means that the Sharia of the Quran and the Prophet is the law and the government through which disputes, for example, are solved.
Yeah.
And through which by people live their lives, financial, education, politics, etc. Right? And this is why we find, for example, that we're not allowed to go and settle disputes in a court of justice that doesn't apply the rules of the Sharia, right? And therefore, as part of the system of wakala, the imam would actually set up small courts of justice to solve disputes based on the ahkam of Islam. So you find that Mufaddal ibn Umar, at the time of sixth imam, he actually has been given money by the imam. Right, and the Imam tells him, إِذَا أَرَيْتَ بَيْنَ اثْنَيْنَ مِنْ شِيَعَتِنَا مُنَازَعَ When you see that there's a dispute, an argument between our Shias, فَافْتَدِهَا مِنْ مَالِ Solve it, right, with this money, from my money, right? Mm-hmm. The Imam would give money. One of the places where the Imam would distribute the funds is to establish these places, for example, in this case with Mufaddal, where the disputes of the Shias would be settled. So they don't have to go outside, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Another place where the imam would spend money is through the family of the shuhada. So throughout the history of this system, people were killed, right? The wakala would get caught, right? They would be tortured, they would be imprisoned, they would be killed. And obviously, there are the families behind them, right? Who supports them? The imam would support them. So you find in many cases, the imam would send money to the families, right? And then obviously there's funds that the system needs, right? So the post office guy has to be paid. The wukala obviously have to be paid, obviously. But although we have many places where the wukala will actually have their own work as well. So there will be oil sellers, for example, or there will be different occupations.
So this would be like a side thing for them.
Yeah. Or it would be actually an excuse to do this secretly as well, right? But still, there an organization requires money for expenditures, right? So the mail that happens, etc. There's costs involved. And obviously the whole system is run by all these funds as well. So the khums, the zakat, all the money that's collected, it also helps the system to run as well. The whole system of wakala. Coming back to our slide, so we talked about teaching Islam, we talked about being a hujjah, we talked about removing confusion, we talked about collecting and distributing funds. The last is protecting the Shias. One of the things that we have to understand that was very clear about the system is that it helped the Shias to learn about their religion, to be guided, to be protected from confusion, to have the tarbiyah done, to pay their khums and zakat freely without any problems. All of that whilst being free and living safely. And who bared and had to endure the trouble is the wakala themselves.
Hmm.
So this system, one of the roles of the system was to make sure that the people are protected. Because you have people like Hajjaj, you have people like Atama Banu Abbas, okay, that if you were to be a Shia, you would get killed or get into trouble. So how are these Shia supposed to learn their religion from the Ahlul Bayt? How are they supposed to collect the khums, distribute their khums, except give their khums, sorry. It is all had to happen through a system by which they can be protected. Otherwise, nobody will be doing any of these things. So their progress towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will be very much disturbed, or there will be an obstacle. So the presence of the likes of Mufaddal, for example, or Ibn Khunais, for example, right? These guys would be a wakil and would play a role whereby they would be a medium through which the people would come to the imam, and they would bear all the torture and the killing, etc., as a means to protect. And you find that the imams themselves will tell the Shias, don't come to me. Right? We have letters from the Ahlul Bayt to the Shias. Very strong letters sometimes. Right? And even letters to some of the wukala as well. Some of the wukala would come to the imam. The imam says, don't come to me. Go to the bab. Go to some of the other wukalas. Don't come to me. Why? Because life's in danger over here. Right? If anybody finds out you're coming with so much money, you speak to people that you're not supposed to speak to. You come to me directly. People, I'm under surveillance 24/7, the imam says, right? His house is full of spies. If anybody comes to him, they'll think, okay, this guy's a Shia, this guy's a Shia, this guy's a Shia. Right? This guy's a wakil, this guy's collecting money. That can't happen. Right? So for the protection of the Shias, is necessary for the system to be in place. Right?
It's very interesting. It's interesting to have this perspective that the imam will not always after, you know, let's go fight, without wisdom and just, you know, make revolts again and again. At the end of the day, people, they had to protect people's lives, diminish bloodshed. If bloodshed is not necessary and it's not wise to have bloodshed, then they would obviously avoid it and try as much as possible to help people live life, basically. Yeah.
Exactly. And the last one is working towards the establishment of a government. This one is quite obvious, right? It's so clear that in this whole system, one of the main aims that they have is obviously to make sure that the Ahlul Bayt's right, which is the right of being a Khalifa, is established, and attempts made many times. Inshallah, I don't want to go on too much to try and establish this, but obviously there were obstacles, there were big barriers, there were many different things that happened that didn't allow this role to be performed at its highest level. But obviously within small pockets it was done in different forms and shapes. So this was a summary, very, very quick summary. Obviously, the discussion is very lengthy. There's books out there, if I could just mention a couple of books. So there's a book in English actually by Jassim Hossein, right? And in this book, he talks about the system of wakala. I think I've got here. So this Occultation of the 12th Imam by Jassim Hossein. He talks about the... It's a nice book. Obviously, it's not complete. There's much more work could have been done. But it's a good start. There's other books in Farsi. So Jabbari has written 2 volumes on the system of wakala, which is very, very interesting. Obviously, again, a lot could be done, but it's a good work as well. Ayatollah Khamenei is a 250-year-old man, or Divisa Panja Saleh, all 3 volumes. A very, very amazing analysis that he has, where he brings about these different... stories from the lives of the Ahlul Bayt to show that how the system is working so beautifully. And he highlights very much this, the presence of the Ahlul Bayt, right? The imam is active, the imam is managing.
He's there
the imam,
in society, he's not there present, house, yeah.
And he cares for the people, right? He wants the people to grow. He wants them, the poor people, to become richer, to have better lives, right? To be active in society. He wants people, their identity to be preserved, their understanding of Islam, their ma'rifah of Allah, of the imam, their path towards Allah. The imam is actively trying, and throughout the corners of the empire, basically. And all of this happens through a system in place, a very strong system of wakala in place.
Okay, so you've mentioned all of these different roles that the wakala were talking about. So basically, how is the system working now? I guess we'll discuss this in the next session.
Yeah, so in the next session, we'll discuss how these things happened, how there was the system running. So now that I know what they're supposed to be doing, we'll talk about how did it work, right? And moving on from that, we'll talk about the Ghaybat al-Sughra specifically.
Okay, inshallah, brilliant. So that was really interesting. A lot of very new information, which I guess we need to digest. So let's finish the session over here. And then we'll continue discussing this really amazing system that the imams established in order to fulfill their roles that they have through these wukala and through the system, basically. Inshallah, we'll get a bit more insight into it in the next session. So until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.